Good morning and welcome to Frankly Speaking. During today's program, we'll discuss writing for business, academic problems in the business world. I'm Joan Ziemba for George Mason University. Over the last few years, such distinguished periodicals as Forbes, Harvard Business Review, and Nations Magazine have published numerous articles concerning writing in business. Articles concerning reports, letters, memos, proposals prepared by professionals ranging from architects to salesmen. How does your writing style affect your business style? Today, to discuss writing for business with us, to identify some of the common problems and reveal some of the solutions, are Dr. Chris Tice, Director of the Faculty Writing Program of the Northern Virginia Writing Project at George Mason University, and Dr. Richard Koffenberger, Business Attorney and Chairman of the Accounting and Business Law Department at George Mason. There's a lot of joking about governmentese and business jargon. Does that still exist, or are people becoming more concerned about their writing? Dr. Tice?
Well, I think that people have always been concerned about their writing. I think that governmentese jargon that exists within writing within the government or within business or within any other sphere of life comes from several things. Usually one of the goals that writers have is to try to impress who they're writing for. And sometimes one of the most superficial ways to impress an audience is with inflated jargon, with language that the reader just or the listener just doesn't understand. Many times writers will inflate their messages with jargon, with long words, with fashionable words, to try to seem fashionable or, you know, in themselves and what they do. And they're not really concerned with getting the message across to the reader or to the listener. Many of the efforts that are currently going on, say within the legal profession, to rid legal language of jargon that cannot be understood by the layman comes out of a sense that it's not only the lawyer or the judge who's going to have to be reading and understanding the documents, but it's going to have to be the public at large, the people who are involved in legal cases. So this creates a different climate for the person who is writing, you know, the legal language. It's just one example. Suddenly the lawyer has to be concerned with another audience that he's not really accustomed to writing for. And certain things enter into this transaction. He has to rid himself, I guess, of the notion that what he's trying to do is impress somebody with, say, his legal knowledge or his grasp of the facts, his grasp of the case, and that he's really got to try to make the other parties understand. Now, I'm not saying that legal language or business language or government writing has always been intended to somehow cast a smoke screen of superficial glory over the piece of writing. But what I am saying is this, that that's one motive that sometimes people have when they write. Another reason why jargon or governmentese, as we call it, gets into writing has to do with the fact that oftentimes these writers are dealing with a very small clientele, a clientele that really knows the jargon.
That would be their audience?
Right, that would be their audience. So for instance, as I mentioned the lawyers before, well, the lawyers have traditionally been used to writing for a very small group of their peers. Mm-hmm. So they have been, you know, accustomed to using a language that that group understands. And this is true in any sphere. It's certainly true in academic writing, that academics write for, you know, small audiences of other scholars in their fields. And it becomes a problem when those same people have to try to communicate with other groups, you know, that don't know their language. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I mentioned the lawyers before. Suddenly when it becomes an issue that the common person, the layperson, understand what the lawyers are saying, the lawyers have to completely change their notion of what it is, what kinds of language they have to use in communicating. And it's difficult. It's very difficult to do that.
Chris, I think part of the problem that you described is true not only for lawyers and academicians, but for many professionals, many writers, is when you are writing for your colleagues, and you're thinking of that type of audience, I think oftentimes the writer becomes overly concerned with form, and the form starts to dictate, you know, in order to fit into the form, you use a certain type of jargon, phraseology, because you're used to working with that, and it works well into that form, and it sort of spills over into all other writing. Pretty soon you become overly concerned with the form and not, you forget about the audience. And that's true whether you're writing, you know, it's no problem if you're writing for your colleagues, but if you're writing for the layperson, then it's a problem. Because you get involved in the form and using the jargon, and then you stop thinking about, well, will they really understand what I'm saying? By the way, as an aside, some states have actually passed statutory requirements that certain types of legal documents be written in what they call plain English. New York, I believe, is an example. I'm not sure how that's working out because it's fairly new within the last couple of years. But again, it really makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because anybody knowledgeable with the way the legal system works would realize that there are jurisdictions in which judges or magistrates, for example, do not have to be trained in law at all. They're just persons who are either appointed or elected. Okay, the requirement is not necessarily a legal training. If they're going to be interpreting, you know, sort of the first line of the court system, if they're going to be interpreting statutes and case law, it certainly should be written in a way that they can understand it as so-called laymen, so to speak.
Well, what are some of the problems, common problems, experienced by businessmen or women in writing?
Some of the common problems, I would say, what we just mentioned about being able to fit the message to the audience. I'd say that as far as the consumer is concerned, that's probably the major problem. But for the writers themselves, probably as equally important a problem is various kinds of writing anxiety, writing blocks. Many of the people who take technical and report writing courses are people who find it very hard to initiate and complete writing tasks. Many things get in the way. People who are forced by deadlines, for example, to come up with a memo or a report or a proposal find it very difficult to write those things. They're blocked, and sometimes what we do as teachers is we try to get people to understand the sources of their blocks and to help those people deal with the things that are keeping them from initiating and completing the tasks. A lot of times, what Rick mentioned before, there's a hypersensitivity on the part of the writer to formal requirements. Mm-hmm. There's a sense that, for instance, in a relationship with a boss, for example, that a writer knows that the boss likes certain kinds of words. We were talking about jargon mm-hmm. before. Likes certain jargon within a memo or within a report, or likes a certain format. And what many writers do and what keeps them from completing the task is the fact that they feel that when they sit down to write this report or to write this memo, they have very strongly in their consciousness the fact, well, I've got to include this particular piece of jargon that my boss likes, and I've got to have these particular number of paragraphs and this particular format for the piece. And instead of getting down to the task of communicating the message, they make sure that they have all of those formal bases covered.
So the anxiety is almost created from a sense of approval.
Right, right. Almost always anxiety comes out of that sense. And oftentimes it's not only the approval of the boss or the approval of the immediate person, but a kind of a generalized sense of dissatisfaction with what has been written by the person, exists within the person himself. Many times people are their own worst critics. In trying to deal with writing anxieties and blocks of various kinds, what we do is first try to make people aware of the fact of this voice which is inside of their minds. We call it the internal critic, or the disabling voice. That little curmudgeon that is always there, the minute you start to write anything, that is saying to you, no, that's wrong.
Yeah.
I've got to change it. And so hence, you know, what happens is that people, you know, ball up their first drafts and throw them in the trash can, and then they start again and they keep going through that process. And they tend to put it off and put it off and put it off until the last minute. So what we try to do to try to circumvent that is just, as I say, make people aware of that disabling voice. And we say, look, let's try to silence that voice for a little bit. And we try to give people strategies to use to get the information, the message down on the paper. And once it's down on the paper, then let that critic come back in and, you know, start fiddling with what's already down on the page. But at least we try to silence the critic you know, for as long as possible until something has gotten down, been gotten down on the page.
Dr. Kaufenberger, as an attorney to business, have you experienced situations where a person's writing style has affected his business style?
Oh, sure. I can probably give a couple of examples, but one example, as an administrator, when a person is applying for a faculty position, one of the most important parts of the whole process is your cover letter, because that's your initial introduction and the way you catch the employer's or potential employer's eye. And it's important within the first few paragraphs to point out why you're a special person, why this employer or potential employer should be interested in you. Keep in mind that employer is frequently a busy person and gets lots and lots of resumes and cover letters, so that you've got to make yours unique. So I think success in getting a job initially is dependent upon one's writing skills and thinking out, you know, what is special about me? What particular characteristics or skills do I have that would make me suitable for this job? Probably some other examples, or another example, in the legal profession. I think the ability to write clearly and concisely, to say what you or your client wants you to say, is very important. A good example would be in drafting a contract. You've got to be able to say what it is that you and your client want to say. And you don't want to create ambiguities, because that circumvents the whole purpose for drafting the contract in the first place. It's going to create more legal problems than you solve.
I wanted to mention, in relation to something that Rick said before about the quality of a person's work, oftentimes these qualities within a person's writing can be enhanced if the person engages or sees writing as a process, or engages in writing with a sense that it's not only an isolated activity that the writer does, but engages in a kind of dialogue with the person that the writer is serving. We've often looked upon writing as something that you do by yourself. And I think the schools have probably helped to inculcate that. But recently, writing theory has shown that the most successful writing, no matter in what sphere it's done, is done in a sense where a group is participating in it. There is one aspect of the plain English movement is called the document design program. And the document design program, which is being developed in Washington, is focused on a method whereby the writers of government documents get those documents out to the people that they are intended for before the draft is completely finished. While the document is still being designed, it goes in kind of a test phase to the people it's intended to serve. So then the people who are intended to serve read it, comment on it, and so the writers can see whether or not the message is being conveyed concisely and clearly. It's very difficult for a writer to write concisely and clearly and accurately when there's a sense of a vacuum and he really hasn't tested it out on the people that he's attempting to serve.
Chris, I think a good example of that, going back to the legal profession, and I think probably studies would bear this out, I think most attorneys are most comfortable working in a partnership situation, and I also think that, statistics would show that the most successful business organization for an attorney is the partnership. And I think part of that is the reason they feel more comfortable. As you draft a legal document, one, you want to share it with your client to see that the client is satisfied, but you also like to sort of bounce it off of another colleague and ask them to read it, and does this make sense to you as a professional? I think that's part of it, sort of the idea of the what we call the reading writing group, informally.
Well, thank you both. Well, unfortunately, we're about out of time. It's gone very quickly. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University, production coordinator Pat Ping. For information about our guests or this program, please call area code 703-323-2138. I'm Joan Ziemba for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.